This is Audible.
Tim Ferriss Audio presents The Tao of Seneca, Practical Letters from a Stoic Master, Volume 2, performed by John A. Robinson. The following unabridged reading is the second volume of Moral Letters to Lucilius, consisting of letters 66 through 92 of that work. For pronunciation of Latin terms and names, the classical pronunciation has been preferred, although exceptions have been made in cases where it was felt that the reader might lose clarity regarding who or what is being discussed. Special thanks to Erin Shoemate for making her time and expertise available for consultation. Letter 66. On Various Aspects of Virtue. I have just seen my former schoolmate Clarinus for the first time in many years. You need not wait for me to add that he is an old man, but I assure you that I found him hale in spirit and sturdy, although he is wrestling with a frail and feeble body. For nature acted unfairly when she gave him a poor domicile for so rare a soul. Or perhaps it was because she wished to prove to us that an absolutely strong and happy mind can lie hidden under any exterior. Be that as it may, Clarinus overcomes all these hindrances, and by despising his own body has arrived at a stage where he can despise other things also. The poet who sang, "Worth shows more pleasing in a form that's fair," is, in my opinion, mistaken. For virtue needs nothing to set it off. It is its own great glory, and it hallows the body in which it dwells. At any rate, I have begun to regard Clarinus in a different light. He seems to me handsome, and as well set up in body as in mind. A great man can spring from a hovel. So can a beautiful and great soul from an ugly and insignificant body. For this reason, nature seems to me to breed certain men of this stamp with the idea of proving that virtue springs into birth in any place whatever. Had it been possible for her to produce souls by themselves and naked, she would have done so. As it is, nature does a still greater thing, for she produces certain men who, though hampered in their bodies, nonetheless break through the obstruction. I think Clarinus has been produced as a pattern, that we might be enabled to understand that the soul is not disfigured by the ugliness of the body, but rather the opposite, that the body is beautified by the comeliness of the soul. Now, though Clarinus and I have spent very few days together, we have, nevertheless, had many conversations, which I will at once pour forth and pass on to you. The first day, we investigated this problem. How can goods be equal if they are of three kinds? For certain of them, according to our philosophical tenets, are primary, such as joy, peace, and the welfare of one's country. Others are of the second order, molded in an unhappy material, such as the endurance of suffering and self-control during severe illness. We shall pray outright for the goods of the first class. For the second class, we shall pray only if the need shall arise. There is still a third variety, as, for example, a modest gait, a calm and honest countenance, and a bearing that suits the man of wisdom. Now, how can these things be equal when we compare them, if you grant that we ought to pray for the one and avoid the other? If we would make distinctions among them, we had better return to the first good, and consider what its nature is. The soul that gazes upon truth, that is skilled in what should be sought and what should be avoided, establishing standards of value not according to opinion, but according to nature. The soul that penetrates the whole world and directs its contemplating gaze upon all its phenomena, paying strict attention to thoughts and actions, equally great and forceful, superior alike to hardships and blandishments, yielding itself to neither extreme of fortune, rising above all blessings and tribulations, absolutely beautiful. Perfectly equipped with grace as well as with strength, healthy and sinewy, unruffled, undismayed, one which no violence can shatter, one which acts of chance can neither exalt nor depress. A soul like this is virtue itself. There you have its outward appearance, if it should ever come under a single view, and show itself once in all its completeness. But there are many aspects of it. They unfold themselves, according as life varies and as actions differ. But virtue itself does not become less or greater, for the supreme good cannot diminish, nor may virtue retrograde. Rather is it transformed, now into one quality and now into another, shaping itself according to the part which it is to play. Whatever it has touched, it brings into likeness with itself and dies with its own color. It adorns our actions, our friendships, and sometimes entire households, which it has entered and set in order. Whatever it has handled, it forthwith makes lovable, notable, admirable. Therefore, the power and the greatness of virtue cannot rise to greater heights, because increase is denied to that which is superlatively great. You will find nothing straighter than the straight, nothing truer than the true, and nothing more temperate than that which is temperate. Every virtue is limitless, for limits depend upon definite measurements. Constancy cannot advance further, any more than fidelity, or truthfulness, or loyalty. What can be added to that which is perfect? Nothing otherwise that was not perfect, to which something has been added. Nor can anything be added to virtue either, for if anything can be added thereto, it must have contained a defect. Honor, also, permits of no addition, for it is honorable because of the very qualities which I have mentioned. What then? Do you think that propriety, justice, lawfulness do not also belong to the same type, and that they are kept within fixed limits